to me, it's still magic. Like I'm a scientist. Like I understand, kind of there's no magic, but like when you take out a clot and someone gets better, like to me, there's nothing like it. I think it is really one of the most high quality interactions you can have with another human being.
Welcome back to the Neurophilia Podcast, an atypical neurology podcast show focused on dispelling neurophobia one conversation at a time. We hope that these conversations help you develop an appreciation for and perhaps even a love of neurology. Surely this episode will accomplish this because we are joined by the impressive Dr. Ashutosh Jadhav to discuss the growing field of interventional neurology. Dr. Ashutosh Jadhav is a vascular and interventional neurologist at the Barrow Neurological Institute in Phoenix, Arizona. Dr. Jadhav attended Harvard University and graduated magna cum laude with a degree in biochemical sciences. He also received his medical degree and a doctoral in philosophy from Harvard Medical School. He completed his residency and fellowship at Harvard Medical School and University of Pittsburgh. He currently serves as the editor-in-chief of Stroke, Vascular, and Interventional Neurology. Dr. Jadhav, welcome to the Neurophilia Podcast. Thank you so much for taking some time out of your busy schedule to chat with Dr. Bileko and I about the field of interventional neurology.
Thank you, Dr. Goyal and Dr. Bileko, for having me.
Absolutely. And obviously, we have so much to cover over this hour about the field of interventional neurology. So Ashu, we were wondering if you could sort of walk us through your journey into medicine and neurology. Where did it all start? And how did you end up choosing to subspecialize in interventional neurology?
Yeah, I think for me, neurosciences came a little bit later in my training than for some people. When I was in graduate school, I was very compelled by the example of songbirds. So the sort of conventional wisdom is that there's very little meaningful postnatal neurogenesis in humans and adults. And the songbirds are unique because each season they have to have new songs in order to attract a new mate. And the old songs are basically stored in neurons, and those neurons basically die off and generate a signal to generate new neurons that can learn the new song. So this concept of neurogenesis in adults of some sort of vertebrae is really not prevalent across species, but the songbird really captures the imagination that this is possible. And so when I was in graduate school, I worked in a retinal stem cell lab. The retina is a great sort of organ to study neurogenesis and just neurodevelopment because it's so tractable and it's a more manageable system than the brain itself. So during the course of that graduate school studies, I really became interested in ophthalmology. And my thoughts were naively was that when there's retinal degeneration, that we could introduce stem cells to regenerate the retina and restore vision. So that really kind of was where I started this journey in neurosciences. When I went into my clerkships as a medical student, I just didn't resonate with the ophthalmology as a clinical specialty. And I really was attracted to neurology for its thoughtfulness, the sort of logical approach to problems, trying to solve these mysteries. I think that many of us share that are neurologists. And, along that sort of journey, I was thinking about introduction of local stem cells for retinal regeneration. It sort of became sort of intuitive to think about intraarterial introduction of stem cells for patients that have a stroke or some kind of brain injury. So that really kind of put me down the pathway of interventional neurology, which has different terms you'll hear. Interventional neuroradiology or endovascular neurosurgery. There's neuroendovascular surgery. So there's many different terminologies, which reflects how interdisciplinary the specialty is. So when I did my neurology residency, I kind of knew all along that I wanted to do interventional neurology, and I chose neurology as a subspecialty, as kind of the predicate subspecialty to enter the fellowship, because I really liked the organized, systematic approach to the brain that neurology really prepares you for.
I'm curious to know, Can you take us through a little bit for the listeners who may not have as much knowledge about how to get into the field that you're in? How do you approach it through radiology, through neurosurgery? Does it look exactly the same? And also, do you see a trend that's been happening over time with regards to neurologists entering this field compared to how it used to be?
Yeah, so the interesting part of this history is that if you look at the first kind of neuroangiographer, this is attributed to Egas Moniz, who was a neurologist. He actually won the Nobel Prize for frontal lobectomies, which obviously are kind of a tainted history, but his contribution for cerebral angiography lives on. And he was the first one to show that you can inject in the living patient intraarterial contrast and illuminate the blood vessels. That field then was still employed by neurologists. If you talk to some of the old school neurologists, they'll talk about doing carotid sticks and doing angiograms in the sort of old days before there was CT angiography or MR angiography. And so the field has really been a part of neurology for a long time. It became sort of adopted by radiology as an extension of a diagnostic imaging tool that was then co-opted to introduce stents, balloons to deliver drugs. So it really became much more radiology dominant in the 70s, 80s, and even into the 90s. And if you go outside of the US, for example, in Europe, the dominant subspecialty is via radiology. So most of the interventionalists are radiology background. The sort of role of neurosurgeons, for example, in intervention is very little in Europe, and same with neurologists. In the US, what really changed the field was a study called PROACT-2, which was a study that looked at intraarterial prourokinase delivery to patients with the intracranial occlusion. And that really kind of started the initial discussions about training pathways for neurologists and neurosurgeons also. So the field sort of slowly started training neurologists in the early 2000s, but really not that many. And the neurosurgeons also became more interested in this specialty after the results of ISAT, which is a randomized trial comparing clipping versus coiling of aneurysms. So as aneurysm coiling became more prominent, you can see how these two subspecialties became interested, whether it's for ischemia or stroke for neurologists or for aneurysm treatment for neurosurgeons. And so since then, it's become much more formalized. There are formal pathways to get trained. It used to be just apprenticeships. There's no real credentialing. And so now there's basically pathways that are available through neurology, neurosurgery, and radiology as the most dominant ones. And the pathways really add up to about 7 years, irrespective of what specialty you start off with. So usually for radiologists, they'll do the radiology residency followed by diagnostic neuroradiology year, and then 2 years of a fellowship. For neurosurgery, sometimes they will do an infolded year during the neurosurgery residency, and then an additional year afterwards. And then for neurology, currently, there's really two major pathways. One is that you do neurology residency, then you do a stroke fellowship, which is usually 1 year. And then you do 2 years of interventional neurology fellowship, or you can do neurocritical care, which is a 2-year fellowship. So there's many pathways to approach this specialty, which is, I think, what makes it really amazing, because if you look at it from the perspective of advances in the field, everyone's looking at this from a different perspective, and it's really expanding indications and approaches to diseases. So, you know, what we've sort of focused on the last 10 years is endovascular therapy for stroke, and that's really boomed. But there are, you know, people looking at, you know, CSF venous fistula embolization for low pressure headaches. Now, you know, you'll see more and more patients being referred for middle meningeal artery embolization for chronic subdural hematomas. So I think that this is really a prime example in my mind of how, you know, these boundaries of specialties, you know, they're man-made. And they're not really kind of grounded in any kind of reality. They're just something we make up. But the important thing is having people from different perspectives allows us to open up new approaches and new ideas.
I've always said one of the things that I've appreciated about working as a vascular neurologist is being able to learn from different kind of specialty background interventionalists who come in with all maybe a little bit of a unique perspective on how to approach a similar patient. And whenever I am on call with somebody from radiology versus neurosurgery versus neurology, you get just a slightly different perspective and approach from each one. So I was curious to know, from your standpoint, learning from and working with people from neurosurgery and radiology, what do you think a neurologist has that's unique to a neurologist in this field versus your colleagues in the other two specialties?
Yeah, it's a great point. I mean, I think, certainly from a training standpoint, it's really valuable to get exposure to all the subspecialties, and every kind of shop is different. Like some places have radiologists, neurosurgeons, neurologists, or some places may only have one subspecialty. I think that really there's a value for each one. And this is just kind of gross generalizations, but I think the radiologists really have a really amazing handle on anatomy and using imaging to really understand how to think about these 2D images in 3D space. There's some really fantastic resources, for example, from the NYU group that runs a website, if anyone's interested, called neuroangio.org. That's a great imaging resource where they go through different blood vessels and angiograms and really teach. And you can see the real passion coming through from that group, predominantly radiology-driven website. I think that the neurosurgeons do a really nice job of trying to balance the endovascular and open approaches to problems. There are environments where there's not good access to micro neurosurgery. And so those places end up resorting to endovascular solutions that may be suboptimal because they don't have access to open surgery. And I think that neurologists, and again, I'm biased, this is the subspecialty I chose. The real added sort of dimension here is that we really think about these problems from a physiological perspective. I think that it's easy, or it can be tempting in a visual subspecialty for it to become sort of fixing an image. And of course, behind that image is a person and a patient. And I think that when we approach these problems from a neurology background, we really think about, does this blockage explain the symptoms? Does this sort of branch that's out, does it explain the level of deficit? Understanding, is this a patient where maybe it makes sense to skip thrombolytics? Maybe, this IC terminus occlusion is not going to really respond, and maybe going straight for thrombectomy makes more sense. When I take call, for example, I'm on call for both, giving thrombolysis, telemedicine, as well as for endovascular. So I really kind of managed that patient from A through Z. But I think more importantly, and this is kind of what drove me, is that when I thought about like, what kind of week do I want? What kind of day do I want? What kind of practice do I want? What I really enjoy is that I see patients on the camera, give lytics, they come over, we do a thrombectomy. I see them in the ICU, I see them in the hospital, stay, do the workup. And then I see them in clinic. And I think that there is very few things I can think of where you can see a patient from the minute they enter the door to the recovery and be critical in every part of that patient's care. I think that's what really makes this special, is that these patients really stay with you. And, you really, that, and this is kind of, again, oversimplified, but when I think about, the sort of A through Z of medicine, it used to kind of puzzle me. It's like, okay, like you're going to like see the patient, do the exam, give the lytics, and then you're going to ship them off to the angio suite where in the black box, someone else is going to do something and then they come back to you. And, it's sort of like, well, why can't we be part of that black box and do that part of the procedure? And now there's a lot of nuances to these indications and approaches, because you have patients with distal occlusions, you have patients with large core, you have patients with low NIH. I think having the neurological, physiological basis, it's just a low NIH where the patient's blood pressures are, pretty normal and they can sit up and not have an exam change. Or is this a patient where the blood pressure is really elevated and that they set up this fluctuation, and you really have to start integrating the clinical exam with the imaging findings and say, okay, I'm really worried about the second patient with the low NIH because they have a different physiology than the first patient, where maybe it's the same picture, but radiographically they may look the same, but clearly the physiology is very different.
I was curious, you touched on a little bit of this, and Nupur, you're going to have to jump in and interrupt us at some point, or else we're just going to go off on tangents. But a lot of people, whenever they think about acute stroke care, they think about thrombolysis and endovascular treatment. But the truth of it is that you care for a lot of other conditions that are outside of just acute stroke treatment. And so I was wondering if you could give people an idea of the other conditions that you may see and that you treat, even on an outpatient basis. I don't think a lot of people think about an endovascular specialist doing outpatient procedures and managing people in clinic, like you alluded to. So do you mind giving our listeners a little bit of background about what other conditions you treat on a day-to-day basis?
Yeah, absolutely. So I would say in many clinical practices, and there's a lot of variation, so there may be some procedures not everyone does, but just to kind of give you a spectrum. So generally, when we think about an endovascular practice, there's a divide between kind of diagnostic angiograms and then interventions. So I would say that the diagnostic portion could be somewhere like, 40, 50% of your practice. So those are diagnostic procedures that are conducted to do some kind of evaluation for like a finding of an aneurysm or a fistula or some kind of high flow shunt that you're trying to further characterize with angiography. It could be a carotid stenosis or a middle artery stenosis, something that you're trying to work up. Moya-moya, vasculopathy, pulse cloud tinnitus can sometimes have a vascular etiology. So these are all situations where we're taking pictures really to further understand what's going on with the patient. And some of these can be sort of dynamic studies. So for example, there's some, dynamic sort of studies where you can have the patients turn their head and there's sort of changes in flow dynamics, such as Bohunter syndrome. There can be sort of situations where the patient has a whooshing sound in their ear and you see venous stenosis and you compress it and the stenosis goes away. So a lot of these things can sort of be dynamically tested using angiography more than just with a CTA or an MRA. So that's, I would say, about 40, 50% of the sort of practice for most people. And then the other half ends up being commonly on the ischemic side, thrombectomies and carotid stenting. So we do a lot of those type of procedures for symptomatic carotids. Recently, CMS had a ruling that has put CEA and stenting on the same kind of level in terms of CMS approval. So I think we will be seeing more people doing stenting for symptomatic carotids, and asymptomatic is a whole other topic with CREST 2 results still pending. And then there's intracranial atherosclerotic disease, where we do occasionally on patients who are failing medical therapy perform angioplasty and stenting for ICAD, but again, that's less common. On the hemorrhagic side, the most common condition that we see is intracranial aneurysms. They can be incidental or ruptured. When they're ruptured, often they are preferentially treated with an endovascular treatment. About 70% are amenable to endovascular treatment. And then some of them get clipped, which is where it's really nice to have a collaboration with neurosurgical colleagues to understand what's the best for the patient. When they're unruptured, it's again, being kind of a neurologist and then transitioning to a procedurist, a lot of this comes down to who to treat, when to treat, do they need treatment, or a lot of patients just want reassurance. They want to know that this is the lesion, an expert saw it, they kind of reviewed it, and they feel like this is something that can be monitored. Less common are going to be arteriovenous malformations and fistulas. These are high flow lesions that can sometimes present with symptoms or with rupture, in which case they do require treatment. Often these are multidisciplinary decisions. AVMs tend to require perhaps embolization, perhaps surgical resection or gamma knife. So again, very nice interdisciplinary discussion for those lesions. The other things that you may sort of see is like head and neck. So we see tumors, we do embolization, preoperative embolization, epistaxis ends up being something that you never thought as a neurologist you'd be sort of addressing, but it is something that's amenable to endovascular treatment. And then there are other people, not my practice, but there are people that do kyphoplasty, vertebroplasty. There is, you know, some folks that really get subspecialized in facial angiomas and sort of superficial lesions that can be amenable to chemotherapy. And then I think in terms of the landscape, that's kind of really what's getting exciting. So nowadays, there's some appreciation that migraines, for example, are neuropathies. There's enlargement of the middle meningeal artery, and some of those patients may benefit from intra-arterial infusions. So that's kind of in the research phase, but there are off-label situations where we treat those patients. And then I think probably the other sort of, you know, blind spot or area that we forget about is venous pathology. So we do venous stenting for patients with, you know, intracranial hypertension secondary to venous outflow issues. So that is a case where they're kind of diagnosed as pseudo tumor, but it turns out that it's actually a structural issue. And then they don't respond to shunting, they don't respond to medical therapy. And what you really need to do is put a stent across it. So that's kind of a flavor of the type of procedures we do.
For anybody out there listening, as a neurologist who says, oh, I think I like procedures too, or I'd like to do something technical, if they're not excited about just listening to everything that you describe of what you're doing day in and day out, I don't know if anything will get them excited. So thanks for taking us through that. And then I just wanted to backtrack for 1 second. You know, in the acute phase of when you meet a patient, you know, this is one of the most vulnerable times that we see patients. Clearly, there's something happening. The family is usually upset. The patient themselves are extremely terrified of what's happening. How do you create, obviously, we know time is brain. How do you create that rapport and that relationship with a patient extremely quickly to say, hey, this is what's going on. You have a lot of explanation to do. You have to do it all quickly. And then all of a sudden you whisk somebody away and say, we have to do this procedure on your brain. I'm just curious, what's your approach to creating that rapport up front in such a kind of high real estate timing?
Yeah, I mean, I think that the probably most time sensitive scenario is mechanical thrombectomy for a large vessel occlusion. So those patients, we don't have a lot of time. If they're transfers, we have a little bit more time to at least have a conversation. I would say that nowadays this has become such standard of care that oftentimes if we can't get a hold of family, we just proceed without consent. So really this is something that I would make akin to, you know, cardiac arrest or something where, you know, you're really trying to resuscitate an organ and you may not have the benefit or the opportunity to talk to family. But we try in each case to try to talk to family. And I think that as they expand, as the indications are expanding and as we're treating patients kind of off label, it becomes more and more important to say, you know, this is not something that's well studied, but we think in this distal occlusion or this low NIH patient that we can benefit the patient with this procedure. And, you know, I tend to kind of use this analogy of there's a house on fire and we want to put out the fire. You know, there's already damage from the fire, so we can't reverse what's already happened. And then as we try to put out that fire, there can be, you know, damage that can happen that's not intended. So, you know, these procedures carry complication rates of up to 10%. And those complications can, you know, certainly make the patient worse. You know, you can certainly have a mortality on the table if you have a perforation that's very significant. So these are procedures that when they go well, they go well, but they can really go badly. And it's kind of an important reminder that it is, you know, it's a type of brain surgery that we're doing where we are, you know, putting wires in delicate blood vessels. So I think that most families really get it right away, especially nowadays. There's a lot of public awareness. I think IV thrombolysis really opened the doorway. And ironically, you know, the sort of mindset with thrombectomy is even in some ways more open because you're not giving chemicals, we're not giving drugs that can cause hemorrhagic transformation. These are just a mechanical concept. So I think intuitively, it's very easy for patients to understand what's going on and what we're doing. But I think what's really important is managing expectations that these are not all home runs, that just because we take out the clot, again, the fire analogy, if half the house is burned down, we can't really reverse that. So I think managing expectations and then, you know, kind of communicating afterwards. But nowadays, I think if you look at the medical legal literature, you know, most lawsuits are happening because people don't give thrombolytics or don't do thrombectomy. And most families want treatment. It's kind of unusual. But now, because the treatment works so well for the sort of on-label, you know, guideline patient, the difficult conversations are, well, okay, what happens if the patient, you know, they're 90, but they have a little bit of cognitive impairment, but they're ambulatory. So technically they're maybe MRS of 3, you know, do you offer treatment? Is this something that is sort of appropriate, et cetera. So like these sort of non-guideline patients, I think are where we tend to have more of a discussion because, you know, obviously we don't want to put patients through something they don't want done. But at the same time, you'll be surprised. There'll be patients that are DNR, DNI, but, you know, I tend to do these patients awake. So 90% of my cases are with conscious sedation. And if you tell the family, look, you know, they're DNR, DNI because they have really bad osteoarthritis and they have really poor sort of functional status and they don't want any heroic measures. It's like, well, is thrombectomy a heroic measure? So then you ask the family, okay, like if I take out the clot and there's a 30% chance they're better, back, you know, back to where they were, would they want that? And usually, often people, even if they're DNR, DNI, the families often want that. So, you know, a lot of the kind of the conventional way of thinking about these directives is, it doesn't always apply. So we try to have a conversation every time, but it's, if it's a clear guideline patient, we really treat it as standard of care and just proceed unless, you know, there's some strong hesitation otherwise.
Yeah, I couldn't agree with you more about whenever I'm having these conversations with patients I'm seeing either telemedicine or within the emergency department, it does seem like there's something tangible that they can wrap their head around to say, oh, there's a clot and you can go in and take it out. They are much more willing and asking about that rather than going through the whole IV thrombolysis conversation. So you're spot on there. And I experienced something very similar whenever I have these conversations. And then I think that you know, had just mentioned something else about, you know, what is the right treatment for the right patient. And I often say too, you know, it depends on goals of care and it depends on what quality of life is for different patients, and independence and maintaining independence for a 90-year-old may look very different than what that independence might look like in a 40-year-old. So it is very patient specific. And I love the individualized approach that we take in a lot of these situations more and more as time goes on. So Nuper, get us back on track.
This has been a wonderful conversation, and it's, I want to go back, Asha, to something that you said very early on in the conversation when you talked about the interventional space as being a black box and how oftentimes neuro residents and attendings are sort of involved pre and post, but not really in the black box itself. And so I would love to sort of talk more about getting neurology residents into that black box space, quote unquote, and sort of increasing exposure to interventional neurology very early on for neurology residents. And I can speak anecdotally when I talk to people who are interested and myself interested in interventional neurology, the conversation is often like, you really need to know if you want to do that. The beginning you start your neurology residency. And so you have worked extensively in publishing articles that have sort of advocated for the introduction of a mandatory 4-week or longer period in neurology training to actually explore interventional neurology, and even done studies to sort of pull neurology residents from across the country about whether or not they think that would be helpful in the neurology training. And so I'm wondering if you could talk a little bit more about the pathways for neurology residents to become interested in interventional neurology, and then I'll ask a couple more questions after that.
Yeah, I think that, you know, I really like the title of your podcast. Like, neurophilia to me is it's a great response to neurophobia, which we all hear about, especially as medical students. And then even when you're in practice, you know that this is out there. And I would say that while neurologists, we embrace the neurospace, sometimes what we're not as good about is procedures and doing things that are active. So I would say just like there's like neurophobia, there's procedural phobia and phobia of the procedural space. So we kind of think, okay, the where the gurney stops and goes into the angio suite is where we stop, and you know, call us when you're ready. And I think that every place is different, so I don't want to generalize. There are places where the stroke neurologist actually sits in the control room and, you know, sort of watches the procedure, gives feedback. And I think that those barriers coming down, I think there's more and more sort of a fluid space. We recently had a cover for our journal, the Stroke Vascular Interventional Neurology. And each issue we have an artist do a cover. And this last month's cover, January, is basically the angio suite with all the hooks where all the lead hangs. And then the last one is a white coat with a reflex hammer. And that to me is like a perfect picture, which is that really this is interdisciplinary. The neurologist belongs in that control room just like everybody else. And so I think that starts though during residency, even med school, but there is sort of this sense that, okay, this is like sending a patient for a PEG or like a trach. Like you wouldn't go necessarily with your patient to go watch the PEG or to watch any other procedure. So, you know, what's different here? And here, I think the reason it's so critical, even if you're not a proceduralist or even if you don't do intervention, is that A, the anatomy is amazing. I think there's no better way. You know, like Seymour Fisher would say, oh, you learn neurology like one stroke at a time. Well, I think you learn anatomy one angiogram at a time. Like you really understand each person's variance when you see all these angiograms. So I think there's a value of just seeing that. You can see how that patient's getting collaterals. When you see patients with a tandem lesion that gets stented, don't get stented, what was the transit time? You know, the degree of stenosis is not the full picture. How the blood flows helps a lot. So having these time-lapse images of angiography delineate that much better than just a single snapshot. Seeing how the procedures took out the clot. Okay, is this the case where do I give integrilin? Do I give some kind of antiplatelet? Why did I stop here? There's a distal occlusion. Do I go after it? Do I not go after it? So all these questions, again, it seems kind of technical in a way, but I think this is very, very different than the other procedures we send our patients to. So a big part of this is that neurology is a big tent. It's like more than 25 subspecialties. You guys have done a great job covering a lot of these subspecialties, but as you know, there's a ton of subspecialties and we're trying to fit everybody in under this one tent for really three precious years of residency. So it's hard to kind of hit all those notes, but I do think it's absolutely essential that we get neurologists exposure to this. This starts really by encouraging, you know, residents to spend time in the angio suite, hang out with their patients, getting the procedure. You know, this is something that we really, when the residents bring up the patient, we want them to stick around and see what happens. I think that they have a better sense of their patient. They have a better sense of the next few days that when they're taking care of that patient, okay, what did they find? Okay, this patient actually had, you know, a really bad arch. I'm worried that they had a lot of atheroma. This patient has a clad stenosis, not bad enough to need a stent, but there's still a lot of plaque there. Really need to get them on dual antiplatelets. And, you know, a lot of this is just understanding mechanism of the stroke. Like I've seen like tandems where there's a clad stenosis and there's a distal occlusion. Does that patient need like an echo and a hypercoag workup and all the sort of reflexive testing? Probably not. But, you know, these are the kind of things that probably we could integrate better into our understanding of the patient undergoing the procedure. But I think the biggest gap, and I think Blake alluded to this earlier, is just what is the mix of people going to the specialty? And we talked about pathways there. But if you look at trends, if you go back 20 years ago, majority of the specialty was radiology. But now if you look at the applicants, the biggest growing number is neurologist. And it's purely just demographics. Because if you look at residencies for neurosurgery, neurosurgery has about, you know, 240, 247 graduates per year. Neurology now is more than 700 per year. So we're, you know, more than 2 to 1, almost 2.5 to 1. And then within neurosurgery, you know, you kind of go through the numbers, okay, the people do spine and tumor and et cetera. So the group that's going to do endovascular is not that big. And I really think that the numbers are going to be made up for by neurologists. And at least in the US, radiology is still very active, but really the numbers are declining. So I think that neurology is really going to have an important role here, especially as the indications expand as well, as we do more procedures for thrombectomy, but also for other treatments such as chronic headaches or for intraarterial infusion for glioblastoma that people are studying now, or some of these type of procedures where people are looking at potentially doing angioplasty for the ophthalmic artery for glaucoma and for some of these retinopathies. So I think there's going to be things that really change the way the field functions. One really exciting one recently that people are studying in a clinical trial is called the e-shunt. So the e-shunt is really a transvenous shunt that gets placed really as a substitute for putting an EVD or even for a BP shunt. So there's a trial going on right now looking at the e-shunt, which is delivered transvenously for NPH. So these indications are just going to keep expanding. We need the person power to do it. And I think the first thing we need to really kind of get our neurology residents to get over is that procedural phobia.
That's extremely helpful. Thank you for walking through that. And this article that I referenced, I wanted to give the full title, and obviously we'll provide the citation in the episode description. But it was a study that was called Neurology Trainee Attitudes Towards Neurointervention Results from an International Survey. And what I thought was really interesting as one of the main findings was that 73% of neurology residents with a neurology trained interventionalist got exposure, whereas programs where the endovascular treatment was run by radiology or neurosurgery, the exposure for neurology residents was significantly lower. It was about 55%. And so I'm wondering, neurology residents that are coming from institutions which are neurosurgery run or radiology run, do you have ways for neurology residents to sort of bypass any sort of barriers there?
Yeah, I mean, certainly there is kind of this bias, right? So if you have sort of an exposure, it's like the diversity conversations. We need to see diversity for us to see, okay, like someone that does what I do or looks like me does this too. So I think that is part of the conversation. Secondly, I do think that many places are pretty open to having neurologists in the angio suite, even if their background is radiology or neurosurgery, but it's just a matter of kind of breaking that ice and having that conversation. So this is where residency program directors, chairmen really have to be advocates for like a PGY 2 or 3 that may not have, that sort of connection or confidence to try to break that barrier. And maybe it seems like too much work or there's a kind of uphill battle. There are ways to do away rotations or to kind of get involved with some societies that allow you to have mentorship. So, the society I've been involved with, the Society for Vascular and Interventional Neurology, their first meeting was in Boston when I was a medical student. That was like the inaugural meeting. And that's really got me sort of confident that I could do this subspecialty, like uphill battle via neurology, because there were like-minded people that wanted to do it through neurology. And then the third thing, which I've advocated for, which is kind of a little bit more controversial, is I really do think that this should be a required rotation that ACGME and AAN should support, because, we do, I mean, if you think about, I mean, every program is different, but I think about my own residency, we did a 2 weeks of neuro-onc, and we did, I did like, pediatric epilepsy, clinic for a week. And, you do all these rotations, which are very valuable, and the exposure is great. But the landscape has changed significantly for this specific subspecialty. If you look at the needs and the sort of demands for it, I mean, if you kind of look at the history of this, IMS-3 was a trial published in 2013 that showed no benefit of endovascular therapy. So, dark day for everyone. This was like a big shock. And if you go back, it makes a lot of sense. During those days, we didn't have very good devices to open up blood vessels. Our recanalization rates were not very good. So, there's this recanalization hypothesis. You open up the vessel, patient gets better. But if you're not opening up the blood vessel, they don't get better. And that's what we learned from IMS-3, that if your recanalization rates are 40%, you're not going to see good outcomes. Now with stent retrievers, they're 80% and higher. Now, when that trial came out, I was actually first year in my fellowship of endovascular. So I was like, what do I do now? Like EMG or EEG fellowship. But, you know, the subsequent wave of trials, 2015, they were positive and they used dentrevers and higher recanalization rates. But in that interval between 2013 and 2015, there was like editorials written that should we stop training people in this specialty? Like there'll be no jobs for people. Like there was such kind of nihilism about, oh, this stuff doesn't work. And like, you know, we shouldn't necessarily be training so many people. And it's just ironic to go back to that, because now what we learn, if anything, is we have a huge shortage of people to do this procedure. And I think that, you know, ultimately it's one of the most powerful things we can do in medicine, not just neurosciences, but across medicine. There's very few treatments with these kind of small number needs to treat. And I think that for neurology residencies, it's really kind of their responsibility to make this widely available and exposed to their trainees, because they're a critical part of this workforce. And I do think that it's still an uphill battle. Like some programs, it's very facile. You have a good sort of pathway and people can do rotations, electives. There's programs that are integrated into their residency, but the majority don't. And I think that the only way to get around this is if you go to, let's say you have a radiology only angio suite. But if you say, hey, ECGME requires me to spend a week here. I mean, that's what neurosurgery does, right? So neurosurgery, they're required 3 months. Like, you know, think about how busy neurosurgery residency is, but they're requiring their residents, whether they do endovascular or not, 3 months like, out of their residency in the angio suite. So I think that for us as a specialty to require residents to do 1 or 2 weeks out of their, you know, full residency, to me, I think it's a investment worthwhile.
Definitely. And the other question that I wanted to ask you, obviously throughout this whole hour, there's been a mention of a lot of different trials that have obviously changed the landscape in the last decade alone. And so I'm wondering for busy neurology residents, as well as attendings, how do you recommend sort of consolidating and being up to date with the newest and latest in interventional neurology? And I think that this would, you know, perfectly transition us to also talk about your work with the journal Stroke, Vascular, and Interventional Neurology.
Yeah, I mean, I think it's gotten a lot harder. You know, I remember when I was a resident, you had to know like trials, but, you know, we were in that time not having too many positive trials in stroke. So I think you kind of have to know, you know, TOAST and WARS and maybe WARCEF. And then, you know, there's a few hits here and there, but overall it was kind of like NINDS and ECAS-3 and then, you know, just sort of a smattering. Nowadays, it's actually very hard to keep track of how much is being sort of evolving in the landscape. And, you know, I think that there's obviously many publications that are very good in this space to sort of keep tabs on. You know, the sort of big journals obviously have these papers, but also the journal Stroke, the journal Neurointerventional Surgery. The journal that we started 3 years ago is called Stroke, Vascular, and Interventional Neurology, or SVIN Journal. And this was really in response to the fact that Stroke Journal, which is American Heart Association journal, is the only cerebrovascular journal that AHA has. AHA has 12 journals. They're all cardiology or cardiology subspecialty journals. Stroke's been around for about 50 years, and really that's it. About 5 years ago, I would say, after the publication of the positive 2015 trials, we saw a big uptick in the research and the interest in endovascular treatment, that stroke itself started seeing a lot more submissions in this space and saw the need for a subspecialty journal dedicated to endovascular therapy. So when we started this journal, our goals were really to be kind of more of like a modern journal. It's an open access only journal. It's not a print journal, it's online, you know, just for practical reasons. But it is open access because I think part of what's challenging in this space is that things move pretty quickly. The devices change quickly. The indications are expanding pretty quickly. Techniques change. And it's really important for people to have access without barriers. You know, one of the challenges with paywalls I learned this kind of the sort of a roundabout way. Like I have always been in a university setting, you know, for residency and fellowship, and I was at University of Pittsburgh for 9 years. So when I moved to the Barrow Neurological Institute, we're not a university affiliate. And what you realize is when the university rug is pulled on you, you don't have this kind of like endless access to every obscure, you know, journal that's out there. And, you know, if that's, and that's in the US, like in a sort of developed world kind of setting where you have, you still have access to things. If you go outside of the US, and this has really kind of been where my focus has been the last few years, is if you look at sort of from a global health, global disparity standpoint, you know, there's countries that are just never going to have, they can read the abstract and then that's it. They're not going to be able to read papers and keep up with things. So I think there's a general trend overall to move towards open access. I think this is the future of publishing. And so we really felt strongly that if you're going to say, oh, I've got this new technique to do, you know, intracranial stenting, and you put a paywall and say, okay, but you can't read this paper for a year until it gets put on open, you know, paywalls come down, et cetera, you're just not going to reach your audience. And, you know, people are going to really sort of be out of the loop and not really be able to keep up. So I think that open access is key, but there's many ways to sort of keep up with the literature that, you know, there's Journal Watch that has like the stroke section. There are really good social media sort of accounts that do a really good job of reviewing the literature. I'm just going to make one plug here. There's one for neuroradiology that one of my colleagues does. Her name is Lee Alihali, but she does a phenomenal job of teaching on just about every neuroimaging question you ever had. And she's just a great educator. So I think this is the kind of stuff that while there's, it's hard to keep track of things, these are things I did not have when I was going through training. So there are really good sort of teaching tools out there. So I think that it's kind of a hodgepodge. I use social media a lot also to keep tabs on conference, you know, results, because a lot of times, you know, if a result of a trial gets presented, you know, you may not see the paper for a while. Like a good example recently is like the ENRICH trial. So, you know, this was like a clot evacuation trial that was presented at one of the neurosurgical conferences. You know, paper's not out yet, but everyone knew about this result as soon as it was presented. And so I think that there are some ways to kind of keep up with it, but it's tough. I think that the alphabet soup continues to grow every year.
Ashu, another plug is your own X account or Twitter account is a very good one to follow for people out there. And so even though you won't plug yourself, I'll plug you. You know, finding really high yield articles that may have some meaning to different people out there that are trying to keep up, I think your handle is also a really great one to follow for any of our listeners out there. So there's your plug for you, because I know that that's where a lot of us see really, really up-to-date information and articles released. So we all thank you for releasing some articles. And then I love how you just kind of throw them out there and then let us all decide what the importance is. I know that sometimes I'm like scrolling through looking for some of your thoughts on them. And I usually don't get that, but I think it's great how you just kind of put it out there and let people interpret it as they may, because I think that's a really important part of our field.
Yeah, so thank you for saying that. I think one of the great things about being on social media is you do kind of sort of virtually meet people. And certainly, you know, it's been like my way to meet certain people that I've never met in person, but that I follow their accounts and I like really admire their takedown of certain studies. And I think that it's a great community that, like all technologies, there's pluses, minuses, but I think overall the Med Twitter community is very educational.
Ashu, obviously we want to respect your time. The last thing that I wanted to ask you about, and you sort of mentioned this before when you were talking about how there's a growing demand for interventional neurology, not only in the US, but also globally. And I wanted to provide you with the space to talk about one of your recent publications, directly talking about global neurology as well as how it's related to interventional neurology. The title of it being Mechanical Thrombectomy, Global Access for Stroke, MT-GLASS, very catchy name, a mission thrombectomy that was published, I believe, in March of 2023. I was wondering if you wanted to just talk about some of the major takeaways from the study for our audience.
Yeah, so, you know, it's been an interesting journey in this space because we started out with nihilism. Like when I applied for fellowships, you know, you get different kinds of advice. And I think sometimes people tell you, oh, well, you know, no one's going to, you know, train a neurologist. And if they train a neurologist, they may not hire you. And then even if they hire you, thrombectomy doesn't work. So, you know, this is kind of the, you know, nihilism about it. And then sure enough, when I'm doing my fellowship, IMS-3 is published, and it's not just IMS-3, it's synthesis, it's MR rescue. So those three neutral trials published kind of on the same day. And so there was a lot of reason to be nihilistic. And since then, we learned our lessons. We really zoned in on patient selection, looking at time window aspects, site of occlusion, degree of disability, baseline disability, and really found a population that really benefits. And that was really five positive trials in 2015 that were across the world, different countries published on the same topic. And then you had the late time window trials, which were in 2018. They extended the benefit up to 24 hours. So that's been our standard of care. And then I think 2023 has been very kind of remarkable because we've had basically five trials that have shown benefit for large core patients. And so we went from, you know, 2013, like this stuff doesn't work, to like 2023, to when doesn't this stuff work? You know, the sort of benefit of reperfusion is so profound that really we're still looking for that population that doesn't benefit. I mean, the you know, one trial I'll plug is the trial last day, which was done in France. It's been presented, it's under peer review, so it's not been published yet. And that trial enrolled patients with the large vessel occlusion with aspects of 0 to 5. So that trial showed benefit even in patients with the largest strokes, or really, you know, people say, I don't know how to read aspects. Well, maybe they don't need to read aspects because, you know, in this trial, at least patients seem to benefit from aspects 0 to 5. So I think the field's come a long way. So when I started, it was kind of like, there's the science. You know, I did a PhD and very sort of scientifically oriented. What's the data? Can we do the trials, show the benefit? So we did the trials, we showed the benefit. But, you know, one thing that sort of pivots is like when you have a treatment, then you start thinking about, okay, well, we can continue to tweak this, which we do in some of these trials. But then it now becomes an issue of kind of transitioning from, okay, there's medical science and then there's like political science. Like how do you get a treatment to people that are eligible? And the first thing we wanted to do is understand the scope of the problem. So there's a initiative called Mechanical Thrombectomy that was started by Dilip Yavagal, who's an interventional neurologist at University of Miami. And this is really an international global initiative involving more than like 100 countries at this point. But they have really been looking at understanding the disparities of care across different countries. And so one of the projects we took on was just asking the simple question, what is the level of access to thrombectomy in your country? And these are hard data points to capture. The best we could do was survey data, but, you know, we have some internal metrics to kind of understand whether how precise these numbers are. And what we found is there's a big spread in thrombectomy access worldwide, as you might expect. And there's certain countries that do very well. I would say the ones that stand out are Japan and Bahrain. Japan and Bahrain have very high access to thrombectomy. Japan has very good access to MRI imaging, and they actually have a lot of proceduralists for this procedure. So Japan doing very well, Bahrain also doing very well. And then there's countries where there's really no access to thrombectomy, and that's for many different reasons, lack of specialists, lack of people that can do the procedure. You know, countries that are sizable, like most, probably the most recent example, some place like Ethiopia, where there's about 80 million people, they did not have an interventionist till last year. And they have now someone who's a good friend, Dr. Tekle. He practices in Texas, but then he goes to Ethiopia and has started a stroke program and does thrombectomy for the population there. One guy, but he's training additional people. So what we found in this survey is that less than 3% of large vessel occlusions that are, again, these are guideline patients. This is not like some off-label indication. These are guideline patients. Less than 3% get thrombectomy. So, you know, while this 10-year journey has been really exciting and we've really kind of done well on the kind of medical science of things, this is now just kind of like a resource delivery issue. Like, so the first step was to understand, you know, what is the disparity? And then now we're trying to drill down into each geography and understand, well, what are the barriers in this particular geography and how do we try to overcome that? So I think that, you know, we learn a lot of lessons from TPA. I kind of go back to TPA all the time. Thrombolysis took a long time to kind of, you know, become widely adopted and integrated and used. And, you know, there's still places that are kind of coming online with thrombolysis, and we're almost 30 years out since that NDS TPA trial. So with thrombectomy, we just want to see this treatment become available and try to overcome these sort of barriers. So the empty glass is really our first big, you know, cornerstone this to understand the scope of the problem. You know, okay, 10 years later, how are we doing? And, you know, clearly we have a long way to go, but I think that just like PCI for, you know, MI for these other procedures that are life-saving and life-altering, we just hate to see a treatment kind of be available now. We did all the hard work, we did the trials, we can cite all the data, but like if we're not able to translate that into treatments for a majority of the world's population, then clearly there's some opportunities there.
Ashu, I have one last question, and it hits on a couple of things that you talked about throughout this episode. If someone comes to you and says, I have so much interest in neurointervention, I'm so excited about it, but I'm worried there's already a shortage of neurologists, there's an even larger shortage of neurointerventionalists, the schedule of your life is probably very hectic and very busy. What do you tell somebody who kind of sees this life as I'm on call Q2, Q3, I have to keep up with all of this literature? How do you dispel some of that fear of, can I handle a lifestyle like that in the current climate of what neurointervention looks like?
Yeah, I mean, I think it's an important conversation to have, especially nowadays. We're talking about burnout and work-life balance, and I think that it is definitely, you know, a lifestyle that's not for everybody. I would say that, you know, when I started this, I really did have a sense of it because I did rotations. I spent time, you know, rotating with the NGO team. I took call as a resident. So I think it's important to gain that exposure and making sure it's right for you. And certainly, you know, this applies for any specialty. I think that we kind of give this advice to med students who might be like kind of starry-eyed by some very glamorous trauma surgery, you know, shift that they do and then realize that it's kind of a tough lifestyle. And so I think that's an important conversation to have. But, you know, it's interesting because I do think that there isn't a great correlation between how much you work and burnout. I mean, there's a lot of discussion about burnout and we kind of assume it's like, oh, you just work too hard and you burnt out. But I think a lot of it has to do with the quality of interactions. So there's a lot written about this, but there's like this one study that looks at, you know, quality of relationships and quantity of relationships and sense of loneliness and depression. And as you'd expect, like the quantity doesn't really predict much, you know. In fact, it's really kind of all over the place. So you can have a lot of relationships, friendships, acquaintances, etc., a big phone book of people. But what it comes down to is the quality of those relationships and how your time is spent. And so, you know, I feel the same way about burnout. When I look at the specialty, I like the quality of my days are phenomenal. Like I think that what we do in this specialty to me, it's still magic. Like I'm a scientist. Like I understand, you know, kind of there's no magic, but like when you take out a clot and someone gets better, like to me, there's nothing like it. I think it is really one of the most high quality interactions you can have with another human being. That I think that what really drives this is that we focus on, oh, it's your Q2, Q3, there's a lot of hours at work. There's a lot of sort of numbers involved. But to me, it goes back to the quantity versus quality studies when it comes to relationships and depression and loneliness, that I think that you have high quality interactions with the healthcare system, high quality interactions as a provider and a patient. I think that's where, you know, it becomes worthwhile. I think that you can have a 35-hour work week or whatever number sounds good to you. But if it's not a high quality interaction, I think that that person is going to, you know, really have more challenges sort of coping with their sort of life choices. So yes, I 100% agree. This is not for everybody. It's good to sort of test it out. But I can tell you that I've been Q2 or Q3 most of my career. And I think what makes it sustainable for me, at least, or exciting and enjoyable, is like the quality of what we do is just unmatched.
Well, I've yet to meet a neurointerventionalist who is completely unhappy with what they do. And we just wrapped up our interview season for residency this year. And I can tell you that whatever you all are all doing, it's working, because I've never seen so much enthusiasm for vascular neurology and also neurointervention than I have within the last year. And I see it in our own residents, and I see it across the board, even at the medical school level. So I think it's really great. And I know that all the hard work that you and all of your colleagues in this space are doing is really paying off. And at least from a residency PD, I am seeing this more and more. And so your efforts and your hopes of making more people interested with all the research and all the work that you're doing, I think is paying off.
Thank you. Yeah. And please tell them we need them all. So if anyone is interested, please, you know, consider this specialty. And there are a lot of people in the field that you can reach out to and can provide excellent mentorship. And I think that's really been where I've lucked out. I've lucked out with some of the best mentors to this point. And I think a lot of us feel that way, and we want to pay it forward.
Nupur, I think the number one theme of this season is mentorship.
It definitely is, Dr. Vallecko. And Ashi, thank you again so much for just the education you provided, the time that you provided. It's been really great getting to know you and getting to know the field of neurointerventional a lot more. There are two remaining things that we would like to ask you about. The first thing is your 1-minute elevator pitch for interventional neurology.
So I've never done an elevator pitch, so I'm going to give this a shot here. So I would say that if you're interested in a specialty that takes comprehensive care of a patient with a specific problem from A through Z, interventional neurology gives you the chance to really be involved with probably one of the most difficult day in someone's life and really make a difference where that difference will basically change the course of their rest of their lives. So I think that this is a really special opportunity to make a big difference in someone's life.
Beautifully said. And the last thing that we like to do with all of our guest speakers is ask them about their no-brainers. And these are going to be 5 rapid-fire questions that you can respond to with 1 word or 1 sentence maximum. Are you ready to go?
Yes.
Okay. The first question we have is, what was your favorite part of this conversation?
Meeting the two of you.
Likewise. What is your favorite go-to post-call meal?
That's, you know, it's funny because I actually tend to hike post-call, and then I have like a smoothie or like a power shake.
What are you looking forward to the most in 2024?
A lot of things. I would say that This is not scientific, but this year is going to have the most elections of any year worldwide. And I think this is going to be a very powerful year for people to express, exercise their voting power, not just in the US, but worldwide. So I think this is going to be a powerful year for democracy.
If you weren't a neurologist, what would you be doing?
I would be a writer.
What would you write? This is a separate question.
I have a lot of respect for people that can take complicated topics and break them down. So I really enjoy the sort of the experts that can kind of make it such that even someone like myself can understand things. So I think I would love to do almost like investigative journalism or something where there is kind of a shedding a light on sort of otherwise complex topics.
And the last question we have, what are you most proud of?
My children. I have two children. They are good citizens, very curious, a lot of questions. And I think that, and again, this is probably because as a neurologist, we sort of have this bias, but watching like a small human being learn new things, you kind of relearn it yourself, and you kind of appreciate questions that you never thought of because they ask them. And so I really am very proud of them.
In this episode, we discussed the growing field of interventional neurology, the various routes and considerations when becoming an interventionalist, and the most recent developments in the field of interventional neurology. Thank you once again to our brilliant guest, Dr. Ashutosh Jadhav, for joining us on this episode. Thank you for listening to the full episode of the Neurophilia Podcast. Please leave us a review, share the episode with a friend, and follow us on Twitter @NeurophiliaPod for updates on future episodes. See you next time.